I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Nelson Atkins Museum of Art is renowned for its collection of visual fine art. Here you can view everything from paintings to sculpture to photographs and more. But a current exhibit comes with a twist. You don't see it, you hear it. Today we're broadcasting live from Noguchi Court to talk about how the museum met the challenge of presenting 40 individual voices performing one piece of 16th century music. We'll also talk about the expanding role of the Nelson Atkins as a public space with a photographer whose work presents it as more than simply a repository of art. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. That was the Heartland Men's Chorus lending its voices to today's Up to Date. The chorus presents its Kansas City Christmas this Saturday at Yardley Hall on the campus of Johnson County Community College. The concert begins at 8 o'clock. Tickets are available through the Carlson Center box office. What we just heard was a wonderful example of a cappella choral singing. This form has a long tradition of many voices coming together as one with wonderful harmonies. But what if you could hear each voice individually during the performance? That's the premise behind Janet Cardiff 40-part motet, now on display here at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. You heard me right, folks, an art museum with an exhibition you experience not with your eyes, but with your ears. Joining us now to explain how this work and why it's here at the Nelson is Julian Zugasagoitia. He's director and CEO of this museum. Julian, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
Lisa Fanning is also here. She's a curator of contemporary art, and she's handling this exhibit. Lisa, good morning to you, too.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, Lisa, one question. I just listened to this thing. I was just gobsmacked by it. I just thought it was just beyond category, just an extraordinary experience. And one thing I'm wondering is, what's taken museums so long to incorporate sound as well as visual objects you see with your eyes?
Well, we should have been doing it all along.
That's what makes me, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, sound sculpture is, it's not extremely common. It's kind of rare. Janet Cardiff is one of the artist who's most known for it, but there are other works in existence. Anyway, I'm really happy it's here. It's proving to be absolutely an attendance driver. It's transcendent. It's wonderful. People love it. So perhaps we'll be doing more in the future.
You know, it is all of that. I'm just going to tell you again, it's all of that. Julian, What has taken museums so long to incorporate sound like this exhibit here?
Well, we're breaking barriers. Museums today are not what they used to be. So we used to
Well, thank goodness, maybe.
Yes, it's time.
And, it is time.
We think of all the arts coming together. The idea is that we have five senses. We have to use them all. The museum is the place where you can come and live all of those experiences. And a piece like this one really makes you think in a very different way and experience in a very joyful way. So it is the combination, I think, of the museums moving in opening to all the arts and how, again, while we're visually driven, how all of the other arts can be part of the experience.
Now, Lisa, I think it's time we should describe to our listeners what they would hear if they came here, and hopefully what they can hear on their car radios and at home right now, because we can hear some of the sound bleeding across the hallway here. But describe what this experience is, what this exhibit is all about.
Sure. Visitors walk into a room, and there are 40 speakers. They're configured in an oval. They're life-size. They're turned inward. And people are invited to go into the center of the oval of speakers to listen to polyphonic choral music. It's like walking into a piece of music. Each speaker emits one singer of the Salisbury Cathedral Choir singing Thomas Tallis's 40-part motet. Mm. And the voices, they move around from speaker to speaker, almost like call and response. So it is immersive. It's participatory. You can sit in the middle and listen to all of the voices, or you can walk around and listen to each individual speaker. Each speaker is one person.
You know, I love that about this because, again, you can walk up to each speaker, and you're right, you hear something individual, at the same time you can hear the entire chorus singing along.
Yes.
And sometimes you walk up to an individual speaker and what you're hearing seems completely it's out of place with what you're hearing elsewhere, but then you step back and it all again melds together. I've never heard anything like it before in my life.
Yes, well, as I understand it from people who have actually sung this work, it's quite difficult to perform because there are 40 individual voices. It's hard to hear the other singers. So technically, it's very different. So again, this is this very rich opportunity. And this is one of the reasons that the artist wanted to make this piece. She got a CD of Thomas Tallis's 40-part motet and was frustrated because she couldn't hear all 40 voices at once. And that's the genesis of this piece, to create the experience where you can go into it and hear it all.
You know, Julian, I came of age with a bunch of college kids, you know, back in the 70s when we were always arguing about speakers and speaker quality and you wanted to have more speakers and better speakers. Well, this is finally the experience that a bunch of college kids back in the 70s were just dying to have, isn't it?
Totally. And I think the quality of the experience is that each speaker brings one voice,
yeah,
and that you can walk in space as if you were part of a choir. And having your own experience, you can gravitate to one voice or you can gravitate to the silence. But I think it's the presence. It really brings presence into being. And we could have not timed it better at a time. And I think a lot of people are searching for something spiritual. This piece is amazing for that.
It is all of that. Let's do this right now. Let's listen to a little bit of Spem in Ilium here at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art.
Thank you.
as beautiful as that is, the experience here at the museum, just trust me, it's a different experience. And it's just, again, I'm going to get repetitive here today. It's an extraordinary experience. Lisa, what was Cardiff's goal with this particular arrangement when it came to pointing all these speakers inward? What was she trying to achieve?
I think I'd like to sort of speak to the idea of creating, her idea of creating a very pure experience in this work.
Yeah.
And she also put a lot of requirements on the installation of it.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yes, and the reason she did that was to preserve the integrity and the purity of the piece for the visitor experience. So, for example, she requires that there be one entrance into the exhibition and one exit out, and they have to be the same. So one way in, same way out.
And why, do you know?
I'm coming.
You're getting there.
I'm coming.
Yeah.
She also restricts what kind of written materials can be put in the exhibition where the speakers are. So that meant that we had to create this gallery space just adjacent to it.
It's which, very spare inside the room with
the
speakers.
It's very spare. It's cathedral-like completely. Mm-hmm. And also, this is the first time that we've been able to have the blinds open in this space. So it's flooded with light. It's very cathedral-like. So all the restrictions that she put on that, like, for example, no phones, no talking, it's all to preserve this experience inside the speakers.
It took you guys some time before you could get this. Tell us about the first time you experienced this, Lisa.
It was in 2001, and it was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Mm. And I knew when I encountered it that I had discovered a work of art that was absolutely transformative. It was extraordinary.
This before or after 9/11?
I think it was after. I really became committed to bringing it to Kansas City, totally committed to it, because it's just so amazing. Not all works of art are created equal. And so I heard it again in 2013 at the Art Gallery of Ontario, and the timing was right for us. So once we committed to doing it, then we had to get on a waiting list. This piece is owned by the National Gallery of Canada, and it's so popular. It's been at over 50 locations around the world. So we had to wait a little while, and knowing how extraordinary it was, that was hard. But as Julianne mentioned earlier, the timing is right, given the political climate. We have the holidays. So it's just perfect to have it now.
Well, just 15 years, Lisa. You know, Julianne, you need somebody who can move a little faster than that, don't you?
Museums were slow machines. We are slow machines.
But you have to be patient, don't you, in what you do?
If you think that we're preserving 5,000 years of history, 15 years all of a sudden seem quick.
And if our listeners can hear, again, the ambient sound here, what's coming over the transom is the chorus at the end of this piece. People are just chatting like any group of people would once they've been through a challenging experience here. And you can hear that part, too.
Yeah. The sound, the actual piece of music is 11 minutes, and then there's a three-minute intermission. Janet Cardiff, while she was recording this, one of the little girls who's part of the voices, she needed to go to the washroom. So the artist was listening to the choir chatting and talking. People yawn. Someone warms up a little bit. And she thought it would be really awesome to let the recording go. So there is this three intermission. And some people have really responded to it in a very interesting way. It's sort of like the profane of being a real human. Someone yawns, actually.
Yeah.
And then followed by this a cappella song, which is transcendent, so sacred and profane.
Yeah. Well, let's do this now. I want to listen to a piece that one of our producers, Luke Martin, put together, where he actually walked around the room and recorded the sound both in total and from the individual speakers. And this will give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what this experience is like.
Thank you.
We're coming to you live this morning from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and this is one of those days for Up to Date that's just one of those perfect days. We're sitting in a court next to the courtyard here. It's snowing outside. We're listening to this beautiful music. It's just an extraordinary day. The piece again, Janet Cardiff, 40-part motet, on display through March 19th at the Nelson Atkins. You can buy tickets to hear it through the museum's website. What do we know about Janet Cardiff herself, Lisa? Can you tell us about her?
Oh, she is. She's quite well known around the world. She is known for her sound sculpture. She did a fantastic piece at Documenta, the last Documenta that was in 2012. Mm-hmm. It was a piece, Speakers in a Forest. It was called Forest. She does video walks using an iPhone where you listen to her directions and you move through particular spaces. So she's very famous. We would have loved to have her come to talk, but she's around the world and couldn't come.
Did the technical requirements also include the speakers themselves?
The speakers are part of the work of the art itself. They come with it, along with the hard drive and the amplifiers. And we.
I was going to say, how much juice does it take to run all those speakers?
Oh, I have no idea. We'd have to ask IT.
Yes.
But she does have. She has a fellow who is on retainer with her. He follows this piece around the world. He's a tunemeister. His name's Titus, and he comes all the way from Berlin. He came here. He was here for 3 days.
Oh my gosh.
He set the speakers. He tuned the speakers, each voice, and he set the volume. The volume is specific to the site everywhere this goes, and I understand that this was a little challenging for him. He's accustomed to installing it in a rectangular shaped gallery. Ours is completely asymmetrical with the ceiling height that is varied, so it was a challenge, but he managed and it's all perfect.
Well, that's just amazing. You know, Julian, one thing that strikes me about this piece is it's from the Renaissance, but there's also a whole lot of contemporary aspects to it.
Totally. The music is Renaissance, and it's choral music. And on the other side, it's a contemporary artist. And I think she manages to create a secular chapel here at the Nelson Atkins that features, also for the first time, the architecture of Stephen Hall, of this building, in an unprecedented way. Because as you hear it for the second or third time, you start also focusing on the space and the nature and how light, as Lisa was saying, now is coming in. See it in the morning, different spirit, see it at night with artificial light. So I think it's something that is very special.
You know, I'm wondering about Spem and Allium reportedly was first performed in a noble country house in an octagonal banquet hall. Speculation has it that Talus arranged, you know, the eight choirs around the hall, much like the speakers are arranged here. Do you know if Janet was aware of the origin story when she was designing this thing, Lisa?
Oh, I'm sure she was. Yeah. She does an incredible amount of research into everything she does, so I'm completely positive that she knew that.
Now, Julian, I'm also wondering about how do you see these non-traditional exhibits like this fitting into the expanding role you see for the Nelson Atkins going forward?
Well, I think it is exactly what we are trying to make sure everybody understands, is that the Nelson is a place to experience experiences. So we're trying to provide experiences. So it's experiences about art, it's about education, about being together, about senses. So there could be a day that we would do a perfume exhibition where the sense of smell would be there. We did.
Are those things happening?
Yes. And actually, the Museum of Art and Design in New York had one that we started to explore. So yes, there is a way of engaging all the senses. When we had the Adrienne Ferrai exhibition, it was really a design exhibition, but the design was about the making of taste and how he cooks. So we're starting to explore all of the elements that are design, experiential, and that also are transformative. And I think today's world, all the disciplines are interconnected. And that is what I think the museum wants to bring, is that all disciplines are together. And also all intellectual matters, art history, of course, but also philosophy, sociology, economy, all of this enriches how we present things, how we interpret it, and how we experience them.
Lisa, what is a motet? I should have asked that earlier on. A lot of folks might not be familiar with that term.
That's a really good question. Motet refers to a sacred piece of music sung a cappella.
and yes. others. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, with multiple voices, yes.
What about the reactions you're getting to this exhibit? I know you were telling me before the show that some of the responses have been quite emotional.
Oh, the responses to this are absolutely amazing. I couldn't be happier with... We have a... In the adjacent gallery, we have a place where people can leave written responses. And the things that they're saying are so perfect. Words like sublime, it's a time of prayer, sounds like angels singing, I was transported, it's therapeutic. It represents the idea that we are stronger together. People talk to me about crying. They say it's transcendent. Pure harmony. These are just a few words. The responses are extremely articulate. We wondered if people, how long they would linger with this piece, and we've watched...
I was going to ask that question.
We've watched people sit through it three times. I've also had people tell me they have come back three times already, and we've only been open just a very brief period of time. And I was reading some of the visitor response cards the other day, and this fellow walked up to me and tears were streaming down his face, and he said, "This is so beautiful. Thank you so much for bringing it here." He said, I've driven 200 miles, and I'm going to come back again tomorrow. And also, on the visitor response cards, after they say all these wonderful, incredible things, many of them say, thank you for bringing this.
Oh, that's terrific. Julian, tell us about your first time going through this and hearing it.
So, I've been aware of Jen Carter's work for many years, just as Lisa, but this specific piece, actually, my first discovery is here, and it was transcendental also because it was during installation. You could see it, the racks, and it's just you're with yourself. I think what is very beautiful about this piece, as all pieces of art that are transcendental, but it forces you just to seek into yourself.
It does, because you don't want to talk to anybody else when you're in there. There's no signs discouraging that, but you don't want to do it.
All of a sudden, you're inwarding, and it brings emotions, and it brings... Different days have brought different emotions, but it is so beautiful and so powerful what the power of music and the evocation of music brings in ourselves. And I think this piece allows you to be yourself. Most of the pieces, you should act like that and just see what they bring into you. But this is so powerful that you cannot even try to be intellectual about it. You just feel it.
And as I was walking through, any number of folks were sitting there, just sort of sitting by themselves, head down, just absolutely absorbing and obviously feeling okay just doing that, being in a private space and not letting anything else intrude at that point. You know, you're seeing that a lot, I imagine.
Yeah. People's facial expressions are amazing. Some people seem to be meditating. Other people embrace each other. And then you have people who, again, are going right around to all the speakers and listening very carefully.
Do you any sense of what the challenge was to mic each individual singer and then to be able to record each individual singer and then bring it all together at the end, Lisa?
I don't know how... I'm sure it was technically very difficult.
I imagine.
It was recorded at the Salisbury Cathedral, and all the people were mic'd, and then the wires were taken out to some sort of a sound truck where everything was recorded. And then it had to be, you know, blended and balanced afterwards, but I don't know a lot in depth about the technical aspects.
You're going to get asked this a lot, but does she have other projects in the works along these lines?
Oh, she does. No, not like this. This is unique, mm-hmm. and she's moved on now to do entirely different kinds of sound installations. This is, she's not duplicated anything like this.
Yeah. You know, when you're negotiating to bring an exhibit here, is it its placement within the museum? Is that part of the contract then? Is it get that specific?
Sometimes it does. Sometimes, and in this instance, the National Gallery of Canada, working with the artist, they wanted to see our floor plan. They wanted to understand everything about our building and make sure they liked the space.
Wow.
So
wow.
They're very careful about where they allow things to be shown.
Well, Julian, as you gaze out into the courtyard here as the snow is coming down, describe where we're sitting here. What's the name of this room, and where are we here?
So first of all, it's great to, as much as we love coming to your studio, this is a better studio, so come here as much
bad.
As you want.
Not bad.
We are in Noguchi Court, which in of itself is one of the most beautiful spiritual places we have at the Nelson. It is graced with two fountains, with a fountain by Noguchi that also connects the exterior and the interior. It has the sound of water. It is a very soothing and calming place. And today, what is beautiful also is that the transition between the outside and the inside, you start seeing the snow collect on the stones of this fountain.
Yeah.
But it is a preamble to enter into this beautiful exhibition. The other exhibition that also we have concomitantly is Dave Heath, a beautiful photographer that, and his photography, I would describe with one word, empathy. So as you see also that exhibition sometimes, and the music is bleeding into the other show, you see the empathy of the eye of an amazing photographer for whom we're doing a great celebration. And on the other side, your heart is prepared then to enter the Janet Cardiff exhibition, and you can see both with the same ticket.
Well, I want to thank Lisa Fanning for taking some time to visit with us today. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this.
Absolutely. Julian's going to stick around for our second half. When we come back, we'll return to the expanding role of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art as seen through the eyes of a local photographer. That's Mike Sinclair. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, the connection between geography and innovative ideas, and we took time to remember the attack on Pearl Harbor, which happened, of course, 75 years ago today. You can listen to those conversations online at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll learn about UMKC's efforts to encourage a diverse student body, then meet a futurist and figure out how she thinks about and predicts what's to come. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there's a new book out called simply The Nelson, and it's a gift to the 14 families who have been members of the Society of Fellows that support the museum for all the 50 years the Society has been around. The book of photographs is the work of Kansas Cityan Mike Sinclair, who's also a Guggenheim winner. He takes a particular approach to his subjects, and we're about to learn more about his approach to shooting the Nelson right now. Mike, welcome back. So good to have you.
Nice to be here.
Again, Julian Zugasa-Goitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins, is sticking around too. Now, Mike, I was trying to put myself in your shoes. I mean, you know, most everybody in Kansas City already knows what the Nelson looks like and has experienced the museum. Given that, what was the particular challenge of photographing such a well-known place?
Well, I'm not sure that that's true, or at least in my case, it wasn't true. I always thought of the Nelson from the time I was in grade school. I thought about it as the collection. It was this beautiful building that housed this inspiring, for a young artist, inspiring collection of art. And then I moved into the neighborhood, and I realized that it was also this very active public space. And on the weekends, all around the streets would be full of cars parked, families coming, having picnics, playing soccer. And I realized the Nelson had changed in some perhaps fundamental way than the way I thought of it.
Not everybody was going into the museum, is what you're saying.
Right, or that wasn't all they were doing.
Ways. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And a student who I knew came to the Nelson, a student of mine at KU, I asked her what it was about the Nelson that was so attractive, and she said, you know, it's like a public park, but it's better.
Yeah, maybe, and that's what you get at when you told one of our producers that what intrigued you about the Nelson is this dual function of the buildings. What's the dual function in the Nelson's case? Maybe you just articulated it.
Yeah, I think it is this dual function, and it has to do also perhaps with this rise that I think many of us in Kansas City feel, this rise of respect and love for the city, something that a lot of my work has been about just the something trying to get to a kind of an elemental nature of what the city is. And I see that just that energy level here at the Nelson that you didn't see 15 years ago, you know, when people, sociologists were talking about kind of the demise of public life and books like Bowling Alone came out and that we were all just staying in our houses and watching things on screens.
And you're saying you're seeing something different,
right? Yeah, very much different.
Julian, you haven't been here for 15 years, but are you sensing that same duality, dual purpose that Mike just explained here?
Well, I definitely feel that there's an energy in Kansas City at this time, and the arts is fully part of that. And that is part, perhaps, what informed this notion of a cultural district. And the cultural district is the whole city in that sense. And the fact that we are part and making sure that we're part of the fabric of the city in all its dimensions. And that's what the museum is all about. It's also about you coming to the museum in your own terms. And so it could be for the park, it could be for a spiritual experience, it could be just to use the restrooms.
Right.
But
right.
that we're open and we're like a public library, open and free for all to enjoy.
Mike, did you plot out a specific series of photographs for the book you did? Again, it's titled The Nelson. Or are you more organic than that? And do you sort of mosey around the place and shoot what you see that when something interests you? I think I know the answer to this question, by the way. Yeah,
I'm definitely did not plot it out, but I was intrigued. I think maybe the kind of the first step was watching all the other photographers, the portrait photographers, the wedding photographers, that would bring groups here to have their picture taken, that this was the background that they wanted for important events of their life. And so those moments were the first things that I noticed, and I started taking pictures of the photographers taking pictures. And then from there, I did it in the summertime, and I'd go inside, and I'd go outside, and the Nelson was very generous about just kind of letting me roam around.
And that's how you work, right? You try to sort of meld into the background, even though you're someone who, at some point, sort of intrudes in a way.
I try not to intrude, but I'm sure I do. But yeah, I just like to watch.
Doesn't that take more time, ultimately, the approach you're taking, as opposed to plotting out something in advance?
Well, I don't know. I guess it does. I guess it takes more time. I don't think of it that way. I mean, because it's the only way I can work. I can't work the other way, particularly.
You know, Hesse McGraw, who's now the director of the El Paso Museum of Art, wrote this in the book about your work. He said, generally, one of two things happen when looking at Mike Sinclair's photographs. If you've never been to the place photographed, his images urge you to get there. Yet even if you know a place well, you wonder how he made this picture, as the images contain stark discoveries that jolt memory. And I'm wondering, how do you produce images that urge people to go see what you photographed? Can you explain magic like that, or maybe not?
Well, I would like to think, in the best case, it has something to do with the time I've spent thinking about this city and the time I've spent wandering around the city without a camera, perhaps. And maybe if I'm on my game that day, some of that time spent comes out in those photographs.
But every time you wander around without your camera, you're going to come across something that you wish you had your camera for, right?
I do. Yes, definitely.
And what do? You just go back later?
No, I just watch it. I just kind of watch it unfold and try to enjoy watching it without my camera.
You know, you have done another book on Kansas City, a book of photographs. You clearly find Kansas City to be something that's worth your time.
Well, I was born here. I was raised here. I became an artist here, except for going away to school. And I have never gotten tired of looking at it.
That's a great thing.
Yeah, I'm lucky.
Hesse McGraw also writes this: Mike Sinclair has been called the last chronicler of the American dream. I think of him rather as one of our last hunters of common ground. What does that mean to you?
Well, this idea of common ground, or this idea of public space, is something that I don't know if it's at risk, but in some aspects I see it at risk, and I see it undervalued. And so in my work, I've tried to really point at it and point it out. And perhaps when people look at the photographs, they'll get some sense of how public space is a very important part of our country.
you shoot, part of, I think, of what he's saying, Mike, is that you shoot regular folks. You're not shooting celebrities. That'd be the exact opposite of what you do.
Well, you know, I'm regular folk, and that's kind of what's available to me. I don't know if I was somewhere else, I might not, but I like to shoot what's there. I just like to go to a place and try to figure it out.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're coming to you live from Noguchi Court at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Some great music playing in the background here. It's the snow is falling just outside the big windows where we're sitting, and we're joined by photographer Mike Sinclair and Julian Zagasa-Goitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins. And I should point out that some of Mike's shots of the museum, you can see them in the Nelson, photographs by Mike Sinclair on exhibit now through December 21st at the Haw Contemporary Gallery. That's down in the West Bottom, 1600 Liberty in Kansas City, Missouri. Julian, how have you reacted to Mike's work in the book and what you've seen elsewhere? And you're sitting next to him, so I guess you've got to say some nice things here.
So I wouldn't say nice things if I had not been totally transfixed by his work prior to beginning this project. Mm-hmm. But this project was really an act of generosity that was brought to our attention by Bill Haw, who's mm-hmm. the director and owner of Haw Contemporary downtown. And he wanted to do something special to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Society of Fellows. And we were discussing various ideas and how to honor families that have supported this institution continuously for mm-hmm. 50 years that were at the founding. And we were thinking that these people, many of them, also supported early acquisitions of what was contemporary art because of a society that is first wanted to enhance. So we thought it has to be something about art. It has to be something contemporary of today's vision. And I think Bill had the idea, say, hey, let's ask Mike Sinclair if he would want to do something, the photographing what it has become, the new Nelson. And it's interesting, even the title, there was no other conversations between the two of us that said, you can do whatever you want, you have carte blanche to the place, if you need a special access, if you want to go in the reserve, whatever you want, you'll have 24 hours, 7 days a week access to this place. And he's a neighbor, so he could come very quickly. And what came back is a bit the surprise of the beauty of what he just mentioned is, if all of the other books that maybe have been produced is either the architecture, and we have one that is beautiful, the stone and feather that when this building was, but if you see that building, it's only about the architecture of the buildings. Mm-hmm. And this finally connects, and I think it honors a little bit also what has been our new leitmotif, that the Nelson is where the power of art engages the spirit of community. Mm-hmm. And it's also that people coming together, and that's what I think his photographs magically give us. It's a sense of space, that third space that he's referring to.
You once said of your photography, Mike, that I kind of plant the camera in front of people and spend time with them.
That's the way I like to work. I enjoy observing people, and I found that I have an ability to kind of become a part of the crowd and mm-hmm. and not be noticed, and I can kind of work without disturbing the scene very much.
Which is what any photographer sort of wants, right?
Well, it's definitely what I prefer.
Yeah. You know, this transformation you've described, Mike, today of what the Nelson used to be and what it is today as this gathering place, can you envision something in the future that, you know, Julian has described a vision for this place? We're going to get to it here in just a moment. Can you see begin to see what Julian's talking about when he talks about a broader landscape here that would connect the plaza and the east part of the city and everywhere else right here at the Nelson?
Well, and this is a discussion that I had with Julian early on in the process, this idea that the Nelson is really situated in a very wonderful place in the city, a place to kind of form connections that connecting parts of the city that have not been connected before. And this kind of sense that the Nelson, particularly the grounds, I think, you know, you see people out on the grounds. You see all different types of people out on the grounds. It, I think, fundamentally changes the way people who did not form a habit of going in and looking at the collection, it changes the way they think about the space. Mm-hmm. And so it's an addition. It's not, maybe it's not a, it's an addition to the role the Nelson can play in the kind of the public life of the city.
And Julia, maybe this is a great time for you to reset what your own vision for this place is and where it can go, because you've got some very strong thoughts about this.
Totally. I think it is, we articulated that vision early, and little by little it's coming to place. And now, more than ever, I think, and I was reading this morning an author that I love, Junot Diaz, and he published something in The New Yorker recently, and he's quoting Jonathan Lear about the notion of radical hope. Mm-hmm. And I think this, the museum, should be the place of radical hope. And radical hope, he defines it as, he says, and I'm quoting Lear, he says, radical hope is not so much something that you have, but something you practice. It demands flexibility, openness, and what he describes as imaginative excellence. So I think this is the best way to fight despair. And so the museum, as a place of radical hope, as a place also that you reinvent. And I think if you follow us now on our social media, what you can see is a new generation is interpreting this institution in a very different way. They're sharing it, making it their own. And you can see different things going on for different generations on the same day. And what is beautiful is that you can have that.
But you very much want to expand the footprint of this place and the impact on this part of the city. Remind us again what you want to do.
So the footprint is really, well, it's just having the ability to display more art and to engage into more different neighborhoods. But I think the first expansion was a mental expansion of what a museum could be. And because we're acting and having success of that redefinition of what a museum can be, as you can see by the different exhibitions that we have and the audience that are adopting it, now more space would allow us to even deploy more of those strategies.
You're listening to Up to Date. We're in the Noguchi Court at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art with the fountains in the background, talking with Julian Zugasa-Goitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins, and Mike Sinclair, who has photographed a new book, the photographs in a new book titled very simply, The Nelson. You know, are there other museums around the world, Julian, that utilize the space around it in the same way you want to? Are there models out there you're trying to follow?
Well, there are other museums that are nested in beautiful communities, just as we are. And I'm thinking, for instance, the Menil Collection in Houston, or, well, the Louvre. It's in the middle of the city, you know? Mm-hmm. So big museums are part of a fabric. But what we want to be is porous to the society. And perhaps a lot of the designs and a lot of the things that we are discussing also as tangible, as transformative for the urban planning mode, is to make this institution more porous to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west, to expand the institution, first mentally and then physically, to more connections. And we have great neighbors, both through the residential neighbors, but great institutions. So the connections that we have to UMKC to the south, the connections we have to the Art Institute next door, to the Kemper Museum, all of those will get enriched and create more collaborations and more activity to benefit the whole society here.
You know, Mike, I'm wondering, as you make your way around these grounds, if you have favorite spots, because you know this museum and its grounds as well as most people do. Is there a place a place or two that really stand out to you?
So one of my favorite spots is the fountain on the upper level of the sculpture garden. Which makes kind of a courtyard and actually kind of reminds me of the sculpture garden at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Mm. And it's a beautiful spot because it's private, and you feel like you're surrounded by art, but also you can watch the wide range of activity that takes place on the south stairs, the south entrance to the Nelson, which including people exercising and tourists coming. And so it's rich in, maybe it's the spot that has the connection between this idea of what's inside the Nelson and what's going on outside the Nelson.
We talked about this the last time you were on, but one thing that always strikes me about your photographs is that the people who show up in your photographs tend to be more in the background or in the mid-level ground than in the foreground. They aren't portraits in any conventional sense. Why do you go that way? Because I always learned in journalism school that you want people front and center and dominating any image you put together.
So the reason I like to give is that I am interested in this kind of balance between the landscape or the environment and the way people use the way people use that space. But perhaps a more honest answer would be just that it's a more comfortable place for me to be in terms of relationship with other people. I'm someone that at parties I tend to kind of be on the fringe of the party and not in the middle of the party. So that's probably a more accurate answer.
Your work also screams Americana, and a lot of it screams wholesome and small town. Does that sound right?
I don't know. You know, we're entering an interesting time where maybe these ideas are being looked at again of what's wholesome and what are small town values. And so I don't know about that. I don't think of the pictures that way.
Yeah. Julian, I'm wondering, as a director of this place, I know you're busy. You got 1,000 things to do every day, but how often do you get down to the Noguchi Court like this and have a chance to listen to the music and look at the beautiful things here?
Not as often as I'd like.
I can imagine.
And on the other side, the best thing of my job is when patrons come and I will bring them into the gallery so we wander around together and discover new things. And I would also add that thanks to the book and the photographs of Mike, that I saw things of the Nelson that I had not seen as intently. And so there's angles that he photographed that I had never seen, especially I'm thinking right now of the south entrance to the museum.
Right.
There was one angle that it revealed the building in a different way and the people around it. So it's the thing that is most enjoyable is to be able to walk the galleries. But yeah, sometimes time doesn't allow that out as much as I would love.
Well, I want to thank Julian Zugasa-Goitia, Mike Sinclair, for taking some time here. The Nelson, photographs by Mike Sinclair, continues through December 21st at the Hall Contemporary Gallery, 1600 Liberty in Kansas City, Missouri. Mike Sinclair, a Kansas City-based photographer and a 2013 Guggenheim Fellow. So good to have you again, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, always a pleasure to have you here, too.
And it's always a pleasure to have you at the Nelson Act.
We'll do it more often, okay?
Please.
Yeah. Tomorrow on the show, we find out what's being done to encourage diversity at UMKC and learn what the trends of today say about the future. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. We'll take the final few seconds here to listen to the sounds of the 40-part motet here at the Nelson Atkins.